بسم الله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه ومن والاه. السلام عليكم to everybody listening to the episode. It's been a while since you've heard my voice. Some things have been going on, mainly COVID, mainly graduating, mainly not finding a job. But I'm back, and today we've got an exciting episode for me to come back on, Shamima Begum. So just to recap the events. Actually, before we break up the events, we need to introduce our guest hosts. I've totally forgot the format.
I was literally going to say,
you know what?
When
you're away from the panel so much for so long, you know, stuff happens.
Okay, to be honest, the last episode I was hosting, and not the last one, the one before that, the last one was actually a special on Bosnia. But the one before that, that was my first time in a while, and I completely forgot what our email address was. So I was like, Thaqib, what was our email address again? And so it completely ruined the flow.
Live.co.uk. Just mumble it and people just go, oh, right. So we have our co-host, Abdusami Arjumand. Sorry, it's a tongue.
At least you didn't forget my name. Assalamu alaikum, guys.
Alaikum salam. And we have our sister from Scotland. We have diversity now from the UK. Sister Yasmin.
Assalamualaikum.
All right, so a brief recap into the events surrounding Shamima Begum. So in February 2019, a journalist called Anthony Lloyd, who worked for The Times as a war correspondent, managed to locate Shamima Begum in a refugee camp in northern Syria. Surprisingly, she agreed to talk with him, and when she agreed to talk with him, the interview went viral. One of the effects of the interview was huge initiations of debates in the UK surrounding the repatriation of Shamima Begum, whether or not she should be allowed to come back, whether or not she was viewed as a child who was groomed into going to Syria, and a lot of other things as well. The very next day, Sajid Javid, the Home Secretary, decided to act on stripping her citizenship. Now, the issue came with the fact that when you strip somebody's citizenship, you cannot leave them stateless. According to international law, you can't leave them stateless. It's illegal. So the Home Secretary and the UK, the British government's stance on stripping her citizenship was that she was Bangladeshi. Well, her parents are Bangladeshi. So she could go back to Bangladesh and get citizenship from there. Even though she was born in the UK, she grew up in the UK, she didn't know her life in Bangladesh. She'd probably only been once or twice for holidays. You know, like
she's
us, for example.
Been.
Yeah, so
she's
like I've been probably Pakistan once, even though my parents are from there. I know, I'm just shaking his head. They go, no, my God, what's going on with this guy? One time to
what's
Pakistan.
Wrong with you?
Nah, nothing, man. It's just it's one of them ones, isn't it? The UK is my home for now. For the long term,
it is your home.
Yeah.
It is your home until the government decides to take away your citizenship. Apparently,
unless I won't take it away myself. I take control of my life. I take the reins. Listen, have your citizenship back.
But you're British, bro.
Yeah, but 10 years time, bro. Mars is an option, so we see how we go.
Oh, you want to be a Martian? Mashallah. Okay, cool.
Yeah, but so what's happened recently to bring the topic back into the realm of discussion is that the Court of Appeal said that she's allowed to come back to the UK to fight her case because she was denied a fair trial in terms of her citizenship being stripped. Now, I'll let Abdusami go through the details of how she, a girl from East London, ended up in, because you're from East London as well, so you might have known Shamima Begum.
Ouch.
A girl from East London.
Are you trying?
How a girl from East London ended up in Syria, getting married to a foreign fighter, having three children, and then obviously the demise had started from there on. So, yeah.
I mean, to kind of give my two pence on this issue. Back in, I think it was in 2015 when this happened, when she left for Turkey or to Syria via Turkey. She and two of her school friends from a school actually not too far away from where I live and pretty much from the same area as to where I'm from, someone who, you know, at 15 years of age, okay, and 15 years of age, I mean, none of us really had our minds set on anything. You know, we're not even old enough to vote. You know, 15 years old, we're so vulnerable, making, you know, life changes. We're still at the middle of those, you know, troublesome teenage years where, you know, one day you're at war with your parents and the next day you're really emotional and crawling back to them. It's a time where you're extremely vulnerable. And in the spur of the moment, her and three of her friends, you know, groomed from, you know, from by these certain or a certain group, the so-called Islamic State, and you know, for them, they were sold on a vision. They were told about this, that, you know, you're going to be doing this, you're going to be doing that, you can have this, you can have that. And you know, essentially, they were groomed, and there's no way around that. They were young individuals who were innocent in terms of the fact that they were, you know, ma'sum, in the sense that they were people who, you know, they weren't adults; they were still children at the time. And on the spur of the moment, they decided to you know, to travel to Syria and to, you know, enjoy this life of, you know, seldom of bliss. That they were sold, dreams that they were sold, only to find out, of course, it was nothing like that. Two of her friends passed away or were killed. And she was the only one that kind of survived. She managed to get by. And to be honest, it wasn't even, you know, the life that she was promised, of course. She had two previous miscarriages or two previous deaths of children, sorry. And then the third child that she had at the camp during the interview that we mentioned. And even then, you know, shortly after, her third child passed away. And bear in mind, you know, at the time when the story broke out, she was still, what, 18, 19 years old. So a person that young to have now gone through three children that were born and passed away. She's, you know, I don't know in, you know, in what form, in how can we actually be able to judge her? You know, she's quite clearly in some sort of a mess that she's just realized that, you know, how do I get out of this? You know, a child, a young person who's found themselves in this situation, surely on a level of, you know, mental health, she's, you know, seen through so much and gone through so much. Surely there's, you know, a bit of, you know, questions that need to be asked about, you know, was she even, you know, mentally sound in these kind of situations? So yeah, I mean, that's kind of a summary of it, and it's quite interesting to actually talk about that aspect. I think the first aspect we need to start talking about today is that the actual aspect about her case. Is she someone that's innocent? Is she someone that's guilty of, you know, being part of a proscribed organization? Is she a terrorist? You know, is she someone who harbors these opinions? Is she a threat to the security of the UK? And then I think also to be talking about, you know, certain questions that need to be asked is about the actual procedure as well, the actual case itself, revoking her citizenship. What does that tell us about us as migrants? If the UK government are saying that she has eligibility to Bangladeshi citizenship, so therefore, you know, she should just get out of the UK because, you know, you're not one of us. Despite being born here, brought up here, what does that tell you for, you know, for all other people of migrant, you know, background, whether it be first generation or second generation or even third generation, that, you know, the kind of stance that the British government's taking? Are you trying to say that, you know, get out of our country because really, you know, you're not really British, you're really, yeah, you know, Bangladeshi?
So the way in which the government acts with the impunity they act with in terms of surrounding citizenship. So there's Shamima Begum, for example. There's Brother Tox from Syria, which his citizenship was stripped as well with no good reason. Now, when you draw these two comparisons between Shamima Begum and somebody like Tokir, then we can understand truly the position or the status of people who come from subcontinental or from immigrant families to the UK. And we're led to believe that somehow that we've integrated or assimilated so much so that we are now fully British. And the only links that we have with our roots back home is going back for holidays every 2 years or so, you know what I mean? But that's obviously not the case. So the question to be asked here is, So you were right. You said whether or not she's guilty, or if she is guilty, does the government have, is the government correct in taking a stance in saying, okay, she's guilty, but we're not going to deal with it. We'll just let somebody else deal with it because she's not part of our country anymore. It's like a parent saying, oh, you're not my child anymore. You've done something bad. Okay, we're not going to take any responsibility for it, and we're just going to pawn you off to the next person, who that your next of kin, for example, which makes zero sense for me personally. But I don't know whether she's guilty or not. I don't know, because there have been rumors about her being a part of the police service,
the morality police.
Yeah, the morality police. So I'm not fully sure, but
effectively, what's happened with Shamima is that an kind of online trial has taken place, where it's been guided by social media discussion, people that know anything about her, people that, you know, haven't followed her case from the start. I don't even think it's for the government. The government can't fully say whether or not she's innocent or guilty right at this moment. It's not even been established yet whether revoking her citizenship was legal by the government. I think that's a separate question as well, has what they've done legal or not. Obviously, we've got our own opinions, everyone's got an opinion about it, but that's for a court of law to decide. I think people that all of a sudden there's been a lot of discussion that, well, you know, it's almost like you're defending her, but I think people that have that kind of knee-jerk reaction have a fundamental misunderstanding of the way justice works in our country. Criminals aren't denied a fair trial. You know, the worst of our society aren't denied a fair trial. The top lawyers, I don't think Shamima should be any different, regardless of what she's done. She's entitled to a fair trial. She's entitled to legal aid, which she's getting at the moment. Because let's face it, she's sitting in a refugee camp, broke. There's no way for her to pay for her lawyer, to pay for her trial, and it's essentially to get fair representation.
Well, hasn't she, like, so the from what I've heard, is the lawyer's gone to visit her in the camp, and she's refused to speak to her own lawyer. Every single time the lawyer's gone there, she's refused to speak to her. So it's a question of whether or not somebody who is being offered all of these resources in the fight against her says you're being revoked, but she's obviously not really taking it quite seriously. Because if, okay, journalists are one thing. So if a journalist comes to the camp and wants to interview you, you learn from the last time that you will gain too, there's going to be too much kind of hype around a Shamima Begum interview. So we assume that if a lawyer went there, then it'd be different, but it wasn't. Her lawyer went there and her lawyer was turned away, saying that she didn't want to meet her. So if somebody's not meeting their own lawyer, do they really want to engage in the system? Because Shamima's not given any indication of whether or not she wants to come back or not to fight the trial.
And no, she welcomed the decision that she was allowed to come back. And I think, obviously we don't know what her thinking is. Nobody really does it, to be honest. But, you know, I think not speaking to your lawyer doesn't mean you don't believe in the system. I think she, I don't know how much she knows, obviously, about legal, you know, how cases work and stuff. But, you know, it could have been her decision all along that, you know, she was only going to engage when she came back. Because, again, that's her right. In order for her to be able to fairly and effectively represent herself and represent what she's been through, like, even, you know, a lawyer can defend you all you want, but they've not lived through what you've been through either. So it's for her to be able to defend herself. She needs to be here to do that. She can't, the government, obviously the government is going to appeal the decision that the court made, but in order for the government to appeal it, they need to be able to prove that she in Syria, in a refugee camp, can effectively defend herself, which, you know, will be quite hysterical to see. Try.
With the...
To add on to what Yasmin is saying, you know, there is an aspect of, for example, the actual crime itself and being moved to try her for it and how it's going to be done. But the fact of the matter is, you need to be able to be given a chance to a fair trial. Now, just because of the fact that she refused to see her lawyer in a refugee camp doesn't mean that she's, you know, rejecting an opportunity for her to fight against anything. And you know, if anything, I feel like the fact that you know, she's not being given a chance to actually fight her trial from here in the UK provides boundaries in the first place and provides barriers in the first place to actually be able to fight her case. The fact here and the premise here is that we believe that every single person, regardless of what crime they've committed, should be given opportunity to a fair trial, guilty or not guilty. This is just, you know, part of, you know, a person's right is that they should be given a chance. And not, you know, especially from a refugee camp, you know, you cannot, you know, you don't have access to evidence. Forget access to evidence, access to lawyers, and access to whatever whatnot. In a refugee camp, you've got limited supplies for things like food, medicine, drink, warmth. It's, you know,
you've got limited supplies of warmth.
Heaters in it, like electricity. So yeah, the point here is that, you know, within a refugee camp, I mean, come on, I said you've done some aid work as well, and you've seen how life is, at a refugee camp, and you know, can you say that really that, you know, a person is able to, within that environment, be able to fight their legal case?
So when I said whether or not she's actually serious about engaging with the system, it's not because I know, obviously. It's because from what she's showing, it's not really clear. So I was just making a bold assumption.
Yeah, but with, of course.
But with her coming back to the UK, she said before in interviews that she would accept any punishment that was given to her. But at the moment, all of this...
Regardless of what she's done, she's this country's problem. It shouldn't be left to refugee camps to deal with her. She's a British citizen. Well, she was, but she was born and bred here. This is the only country she's ever known. It's not when a case goes bad, all of a sudden the government has the right to then say it's somebody else's problem. They're passing the responsibility to someone else. You know, we're not saying, when we're saying that she has a right to free trial, that's all we're saying. We're not saying that she should be let back into society or whatever. All we're saying is that let her be in a court of law, where they are able to decide whether or not she's guilty or innocent, where they're able to examine the evidence, not rumours by newspapers, whether it's the Daily Mail or the Daily Record or whatever it is, and see what, weigh up what's happened and try her like any other person.
And that's the thing. So, like, the fact that we were talking about how her case is already being made in the media and how she's getting, you know, accused of certain issues, and now she's being kind of the way the coverage has been about her within this whole kind of scenario. It's happened in such a way whereby, you know, straight from the off, we're all attacking her for, you know, because she's done this crime, and the response to this is kick her out of the country. And it's the whole aspect of the idea of passing the monkey. If the monkey here, you know, the idea being that, you know, there's a problem at hand, and, you know, rather than solving it, we're just passing it around. If we believe, for example, that there is a problem at hand, which is the fact that, you know, the radicalism is a problem, we need to deal with radicalism. And I think that, you know, by revoking her citizenship, you're not dealing with radicalism itself. You're not keeping the country safe. If you're talking in the name of security and the name of protecting the country, revoking someone's citizenship does not remove the problem of you know, quote unquote radicalization and, you know, terrorism itself as a concept. And you know, it just shows, for example, the disingenuity in actually fighting this case and actually fighting the problem of countering and preventing extremism or radicalism. And furthermore, you know, when we you know, research that we've done already in terms of research, whether it's done by MI5 reports or whether it be through other NGOs that talk about tackling radicalism, have all talked about, you know, a strong sense of identity is what deters someone from radicalism, for example. Now, this idea of rejecting them, you know, further pushes into the narrative of, you know, us versus them. It further pushes into the narrative of, and the British government needs to understand, by revoking her citizenship, not only are they pushing her away, but so many other young people over here who find it more of a reason as to think, look, the British really don't want to accept us. Because she's brown, because she's Muslim, they've kicked her out. And because of that, even people, young vulnerable people who are like her right now here in the UK, who don't know what to do, who are struggling with the aspect of a British identity because of this whole mess that we're in, you know, the British government needs to understand that, you know, by taking this action, it will not get rid of the problem. In fact, can be counterproductive, just like how they flopped with Prevent itself. The whole idea was to, you know, prevent extremism or prevent radicalism. In reality, it's been counterproductive. It's, you know, it's been pushing people away, and it still is. And the way it's, you know, the way the British government are acting on this specific issue, it's kind of furthering onto this. So yeah, sorry for kind of rambling on.
No, it's fine. We need rambles. Fills the time. I totally agree with you. However, so we have to understand whether or not the UK is willing to basically face the fact that they made a mistake in revoking their citizenship, and that only comes out whether or not Shamiba will be allowed back in the country or not. Now, the courts ruled that she should be allowed to return, but how will she return? That's the question. Isn't it? So the logistics of a return, how is she gonna? Is she gonna walk back? Is she gonna take a bike? Is she gonna take a bus? I don't know. It's quite difficult because most of the time, when courts order, when they set extradition orders, or they judgment comes out that says that the person has to return to the UK for trial, usually it's enforced because the person has run away. But this is an odd time because it's quite difficult to assume that the government will send like a charter jet to go pick her up, because she's not being called back by the government. She's wanting to come back herself to fight the trial. I've not seen anything like this before. I've not read anything like this before. I don't think the UK will send anything to pick her up. I think they'll kind of bury it under the sand for a bit until people forget about it, until Shamima herself loses hope, maybe, and then she's left in a refugee camp for the rest of her life, or maybe she wanders off somewhere else and finds a home. But I think the UK right now has made its stance clear in that they're not going to assist in bringing her back, and rather they will, like Yasmin said, they will appeal the decision.
That's the thing, whatever action takes place, and whatever action that the British government takes, they need to understand that there will be repercussions, and that needs to be taken into account as well. Now, I've talked about, for example, from a point of view of the British problem in terms of when it comes to trying to tackle things like radicalism here in the UK. But let's just think about her for a second, okay? Like, let's just say, okay, fine, for argument's sake, she goes and pursues a Bangladeshi passport. What's going to happen then?
She gets death penalty. Bangladesh, or Sheikh, what's the leader of Bangladesh?
Sheikh Hasina.
You should know. There you go, you should know. He's on it straight away. Sheikh Hasina has said that if she does attempt to come to Bangladesh or try to aim for a citizenship, she will be given the death penalty, because of the government's zero tolerance policy towards terrorism. That's mainly because I think that Bangladesh has had more terror attacks than the UK in the past 10 years. Like, an amazing amount more. It's actually quite astounding. But it doesn't get reported on because it's not in the first world. So we understand Bangladesh's fears in bringing somebody back. But she's an 18-year-old girl. She's hardly going to do any lasting damage. So the issue is really something of whether or not a country is ready to take an ex-member of the Islamic State back into their arms on the public stage, and what that means for them in terms of appearance in front of other states. especially the United States.
But that's why it's not up to the government. I think the day that the government gets to do things unchecked is the day democracy dies in this country.
Plenty of times in the past where the government have been giving rulings and judgments legally and they've ignored them.
And that's why that's why courts exist. We've seen many, many cases where people have taken up a case against the government. Likewise, if the government failed to comply with the court, that's a separate discussion.
The issue of compliance in this case is an issue of international law, as in you can't leave a person stateless by revoking their citizenship. The UK courts are not; they've not decided on it yet. The trial's not been held yet. However, if they do come to the conclusion that it's illegal what the UK is doing, there's no enforcement mechanism in place because it's an international law. The international bodies can't enforce it as well. There's plenty of instances in the past, plenty where international courts have ordered states to fulfill their obligations under international law. And they've gone, yep, no problem, we'll do it. And then like 10 years later, they're not doing anything. It's like asking a kid to clean their room and like 10 years later, the room's still dirty. I'm like, what the hell? It's been 10 years and you've not cleaned your room yet. It's not that hard as well to bring somebody back from Northern Syria for the UK. The UK has done amazing things in the past. You know what I mean? We've aided in sending people to the moon, but we can't bring someone back from Syria. So I think it's not an issue that can be resolved purely by the courts. Because the British courts in this instance, don't really have a power. The only power they had was by saying, all right, yeah, fair trial. She's not got a fair trial. That's against the Human Rights Act. Let's bring her back. And she's there like, okay, so then, no problem.
Let's paint a picture then of, her winning this case of retaining British citizenship. She decides to come back to the UK. Then what happens?
How did she get back? I don't like diving into these hypotheticals is one thing, but
okay, I'm think still trying
to figure out whether or not how she's trying to find a way back in the first place.
Yeah, it's not for us to decide the logistics. I'm sure logistics will be decided by the government. I think,
but the when government she comes said already. Back, so the government said they've said we're not going to bring her back. Like, it's not like the government's got a plane waiting for her, like because the court made a decision.
Okay, let's just say for namesake, okay, she's able to. Her family are able to fund a flight from Damascus to back to the UK. I think
flights should be arrested immediately upon return.
Exactly, that's the question. Because the thing is, let's just say for namesake that she's won the case and she's back in the UK. Is she a wanted person? Will she be arrested straight away? And will she be given a fair trial to prove herself? And what would she be tried under?
I have no idea. It depends what they say she's done. For us, it's kind of like an issue of she joined the Islamic State and that's enough for us to condemn her. But in terms of the judiciary and on what they bring up against her, or what the government says she's done, that's a totally different thing. I can't really speculate on that because she might have done a lot. She might have done nothing. We don't really know. It's all just gossip at the moment. People saying that she used to be part of the morality police, etc., etc. She used to, people, some people, well, it was reported by Syrian sources that she used to sell the suicide vest herself.
And then it was reported on the Daily Mail. And that's
so we can't really trust the Daily Mail, can we? It's like, all right, yeah, safe. You reported a lot of things. But even like Shamima Begum. Wait, my microphone just died. One second.
No, it's fine. But that's the thing. That's the thing. I feel like already her sentence has been made. Her sentence has been set. She's guilty for terrorism and terrorist offences. And that she deserves, 20 years inside or 30 years inside, a life sentence, for example. It feels like from the media coverage out there, and not just that, the amount of public hatred that there is for her, that her sentence has already been set, even if she's guilty. without realizing that, you know, she's someone who at the time was someone who was vulnerable. At the time, she was a child, so she needs to be given a fair trial and be tried as if she was still a child.
I don't agree with that.
You know,
I think with consider,
because if she didn't commit a crime, she was a child.
She was a crime at the time, because I think
it was a crime.
So leaving the UK,
they were a proscribed
organization. Leaving the UK to go to Syria wasn't a crime until like 2017, I think it was. When it took time for Turkey's citizenship to be stripped, because he didn't join a proscribed organization. He was in Syria at the time.
Yeah.
And then obviously they worked through all the people who went to Syria, and then by the time it was like 2020, they finally got to Turkey. I think the issue with her is that she left the country and she joined the Islamic State when she was very young. And now she's an adult. And now the government want to try her. But the government are basically using stuff that she did when she was a child to say that, this is the reason why we stripped her citizenship when she's an adult. And obviously they're going to have to argue that in court. I think the main issue that we should be looking at, as Muslims especially, as Muslims living in the West, is whether or not Shamima Begum is like some other people that we know. Whether or not there are other Shamima Begums out there, whether or not there are social circles on social media, which may have led to her taking these steps, because you have to remember, before Shamima and her two friends went, another girl, Sharmina Begum, had already gone, and she'd known Shamima. So the assumption was that when these three girls left, they were looking for her, they said, and the government hoped for their safe return. And then it was found out that she ended up marrying 10 days later a fighter and having children in them, et cetera, et cetera, and building a new life there. It all kind of escalated really quickly. Like 10 days is a very short amount of time to get your hands stuck in, you know what I mean? Like, I'm fully involved in a terrorist organization now in 10 days, you know what I mean? So we really knew the intention.
Yeah, it's not like, I don't think you go and the Islamic State gives you like a little break type thing, get used to type things there. We know from previous accounts that it is a case of, as soon as you're there, you know, you're in type thing. They deal with you as sana. So it's, I think what we're forgetting is that she was 15 years old and she was groomed. Okay, she was groomed via people that were experienced in this, that people that knew what they were doing. They took advantage of her and her two other friends. I don't think, you know, that the fact that, you know, she's going to need a lot of help to unsee or to get to overcome the things that she saw, and obviously this is, we're not excusing anything that she may have done, and that's the key thing, may have done. We don't know what she's done. Like I said, she may have went there, just sat around type thing. And I don't think it's productive or effective to speculate and hypothesize. I think that's what a court is for, and to lay out these facts I emphasize again, facts, not whatever the has been reported by certain newspapers that we know are completely authentic.
So the issue with I totally agree with you. Like, hypothetical is not the way forward. But when she returns to the UK and she obviously gets brought into this into a courtroom, and she's there to fight her case, and the opposition to her case is the government. It's the it's pretty much the state. Information that usually comes from four cases, evidences, testimony, etc., usually comes from investigations by security services or police services, etc. But since a lot of the stuff that she did was outside the country, most of the information will come from state security, you know, organizations like MI5, etc., etc. That's from the state's side. Now, from her side, a lot of the things that will come will be her testimony alone. Now, whether or not she's regarded as a trusted individual by the court, that's for the court to decide at the time, whether they believe or not she was groomed, etc., etc. Because whether they believe it, whether we believe it or not, it's not going to seem that way. especially to a court being proposed a case by the state and a girl who's got like one lawyer next to her.
Yeah.
She's not even corroborating any of the stories of the lawyer. The lawyer's going to walk in court and go, okay, then what's going on here? It doesn't know what's going on. There's no plan. There's no plan of action.
I think it's a lot more, it's not as simple as that at all. I think, you know, her lawyer knows what he's doing. knows what she's doing. But I think, you know, if we're talking about leaving it to the public's already decided. The public decided that Muslim women are this oppressed, unable to make decisions for themselves. But when it comes to Shamima Begum, 15 years old, all of a sudden she has total autonomy of what she was deciding. You know, she's this empowered woman. She knew what she was doing when she was 15 years old and ran off to Syria. So, you know, obviously there's going to be double standards and hypocrisy when it comes to the court of the public and social media. And that's why we don't rely on it. And that's why we don't, you know, regardless, even if she did nothing, the public's already decided, you know, to use her as a target. You know, what's new for Muslim women is, you know, Shamima Begum breathes and all of a sudden there's 100 different headlines about her. And that's not new for Muslim women. That's you know, regardless of what they've done. It's always going to make a brilliant story. You know, the fact that she's went to Syria and now she wants to come back must have been every editor's biggest dream for a story like that to land on their table. And you can just imagine the delight of certain newspapers when the story came out.
Yeah. Can I ask, for example, does anyone know who her husband was?
Yeah, he was, I think he was a Dutch.
Yeah, he was a Dutch fighter that went.
How much, like, so do you guys know his name?
Joel something. But I think he applied for repatriation to Holland for him and Shamima. But they rejected it as well. That's why she's applying for the UK, most likely, because she can't go back to Holland.
No, so... Because the thing is, in all of this, and the way how everything's been covered, and the way how the government has reacted, and the way how our, you know, media is covering the story, you know, call it a stretch you may, but there is a valid argument, I believe, into saying that the treatment of her has only been magnified and, you know, focused on even more. Because of the fact that, you know, she is a hijabi, because she's an immigrant, she's a person of an immigrant background, and, you know, her skin color is brown.
I think it's mainly because we
Shamima found Begum her. Is a household name almost.
I think it's because we found her. I think when Anthony Lloyd found her in the refugee camp, it was called the biggest scoop of the decade. Because refugees, Abdulsami, you know yourself, huge. Refugee camps are usually huge. Now, to specifically find the person that you're specifically looking for in a camp is quite, like, you know what, it's quite a feat. And to get an interview with her as well. This is a girl in 2008.
Yeah, but we already knew that there was other fighters.
We knew 100%. We knew that a lot of fighters went. We knew that a lot of them are British.
You know, for example, one person that we do know was Jack Letts. Nicknamed Jihadi Jack, right? You know, he's a British convert. He went to Syria. His citizenship wasn't revoked until a long, long time, and he existed in the media long before Shamima Begum. So it does tell you about the privilege that there is even within.
Letts, when they did the interview with Jack Letts, it was a completely different interview. Jack was talking about how he used to sit at home and play PlayStation and this and that to avoid going out a lot of the time. But then you got Shamima Begum in an interview. I think she was 18 when they interviewed her. And she speaks.
The thing is, the problem here isn't the fact that, who managed to get the story and who managed to get what in. It's the fact that the public perception is one thing to be looking at, you know, is to look at in terms of how people view him compared to how they view her. and how, for example, how much, how common of a household name her name is compared to his name. And even more so, the fact that it took so much more longer for his citizenship to be revoked compared to
I don't
hers.
Believe that's down to because she wears a hijab. I don't agree with that. Because when Jack Letts was interviewed, it was a completely different interview. What he was saying was different. His approach to coming back was different. When Shimon Begum was interviewed and people started making memes out of her opening the letter that says her citizenship was revoked, it was mainly because of what she said leading up to the interview, leading up to her opening the letter.
No,
because there were two separate interviews.
The government didn't decide to revoke her citizenship based on one.
It was one day later. They had the intention of doing it because from her appearance in the first interview with Andrew Lloyd, she started talking about, how she doesn't regret what happened. She doesn't think that the Islamic State were necessarily wrong, but it was plagued by corruption. And she said, with a better organization, they could have gone further. And then Anthony started asking her specifically about beheading videos and what she thought about this and what she thought about that. You know, just getting a take on stuff so people could understand what she thinks. And then she started coming out with stuff about she doesn't disagree with the beheading of Kuffar because the Shia do it in Iraq, she said, in terms of the attacks on minorities. When asked about Yazidi women, for example. And then they interviewed her again. And then from the initial interview, everyone got an idea of who Shimon Begum was or who they thought she was. Because a lot, I think, personally, Anthony Lloyd, the interview was very dishonest because there are cuts in the interview and we don't know what are in those cuts. And I do think that he kind of led her on to kind of say a lot of things, for example, because a lot of the things she said were too good to be true for a journalist. If a journalist interviews somebody like Shimia Begum and she starts coming up with that stuff, it's like gold mine, isn't it? So of course I do believe there were leading questions. However, I believe this interview and her response to the questions asked by Anthony Lloyd, hugely contribute to the fact that she was her citizenship was revoked the next day compared to Jack Letts. Jack Letts was talking about how he used to play PlayStation in his house.
Jack Letts also said that he celebrated the Paris terrorist attacks.
Yeah, he did. He did say that. But he also said that he never engaged in any terror attacks. He never engaged with any of the. He was asked to join the morality police, for example. His friends were in the morality police. He was asked to join certain frontline fighting forces when they were going out on expeditions, and he said himself, he openly, that he admitted he was a coward. And people obviously they warm faster with cowards, because we know the guy can't do anything to us. But with somebody like Shamima Begum, it's a bit more difficult because here we are looking at a girl who's around 18 years old at the time of her interview, and she's saying stuff like this. This is quite outstanding that she's saying stuff like the beheading of Kuffar is necessary.
Regardless, whatever she said, right? It's so much easier to paint a Muslim woman in a hijab as the bad person, right? A white guy that's done probably, you know, that could have done the exact same crimes, is so much more easier to paint in a whole different light. The way the interviews were done were completely different. There was a lot more sympathy with Jack Letts. I'm not defending or condoning either of them. All I'm saying is that the treatment of both of them has not been the same, and so we can't judge them on the same. We can't judge them on the same kind of level, almost.
Yeah, 100%. Because when Jack Letts was interviewed, he was in a house. Shimon Begum was in a refugee camp. The condition of the people are completely different.
And that's the thing, exactly. And the thing is, and that goes to show, for example, the attitude that the government has, or the attitude that the general public has as well. And it comes to the idea that, you know, it's very unfortunate to say this, but the fact that there is even white privilege when it comes to this. And the fact is, for example, if he was to be tried here in the UK, and she was to be tried in the UK, she'd no doubt get the most severe punishment, despite the fact that she was someone who was genuinely, groomed. Whether or not that's someone that's something that the courts should be deciding. But the fact is that, because of the fact that she's, brown, she's been told, no, go away. You can go to your brown country and get citizenship from there. rather than acknowledging that she's a British citizen, she's been brought, you know, born and brought up in the UK. She's never been to Bangladesh, and yet it took you so much more, so much less time to kind of revoke her citizenship. And you know, it's just, you know, in a way we can say that, you know, fair enough. There's not enough empirical data to, you know, to be suggesting this as a hypothesis. But you know, let's come on. You know, let's be quite true over here, and let's have a frank conversation, which is the fact that, you know, no doubt she's been treated differently because of the fact that she's got hijab, because of the fact that she's wearing a black abaya. Let's just look at, for example, the actions that have happened, and what she's done, what he's done. Can we actually say that, you know, he's less guilty and that he's more innocent compared to her?
The perception was different. I think that was purpose.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think it was purposely. She's the
jihadi bride. You know, it's the coverage of her has been, you know, put on every type of layer on it. It's been Islamophobic, it's been sexist, it's been racist, you know, every layer out there. It's so easy as it is to paint a Muslim woman in that way without her having done anything, right? Never mind Shamima Begum. I think, you know, the memes about her, the jokes about her, it says so much about the public image of Muslim women. It's really bad.
I think another thing we need to move on to is whether or not... So if we move the discussion away from Shamima Begum as a person, and we kind of focus on the environment in which she was, well, this so-called jihadi bride was produced in the first place. Most people attribute it to social media. Now, for example, saying that Shamima Begum was groomed, which is probably the most likely scenario, how was she groomed online? And can we add some kind of light to it? Because obviously we've all got social media here. And we all know the effects of social media, but we don't know the effects that much because we're not 15-year-old girls. We're not as impressionable as young women, you know what I mean? Or as young men, or people who are young and recruited to these organizations. But we identify certain markers online that can, you know, we can say, okay, you know what? If a young kid saw this, they'd probably kind of agree with it too, or they'd be easily led into a certain trap. Do you think that social media companies share the blame for a lot of the things that are happening? Particularly in Shamima Begum's case, companies like Twitter or Facebook, etc., etc., particularly Facebook, because of the amount of resistance they're giving to regulation from the government in terms of their content.
I think, of course, they share a part of the blame. I think there is not enough monitoring of what content is online and what's up there. I think my memory is really bad, but recently there was a woman that was tried and found guilty of that was charged for attempting to, she had plans and to commit acts of terror within London. I think it was she was planning to bomb a cathedral or something. What came after that was, if you went onto her YouTube account, she had made loads and loads and loads of playlists. And all that content was still up there. You know, she was actively making these playlists to encourage people to follow her way of thinking. And, you know, whatever lectures or videos or recruitment material that she saw was still up there. I'm talking like a month ago or something. This was very recent. And like, you know, the stuff that led to her radicalization was still up there. So, you know, it's not hard at all on the internet to find what you want. And I think that material is being allowed to stay up there. Then it's no wonder that people are being radicalized.
Yeah. I think definitely, you know, the blame does of course go to, you know, towards social media and an aspect, you know, we need to actually analyze and look into, for example, you know, how are social media platforms, you know, regulated, and the fact of the matter is that, you know, a lot of them do get away with it because of the fact that they're not really under any form of media regulation because they're not necessarily defined as press, and therefore the same amount of regulations that apply on press, whether it be for example things that have been set by the the IPO, the completely forgot about the name of the IPSO, sorry, IPSO. For example, none of these kind of restrictions or regulations apply to social media platforms. And the fact of the matter is, they should be, because, social media is media. It's a place where news is spread. It's a place where people learn about things. And the thing is, expanding this into not just things about, related to radicalism and stuff, but also with regards to, for example, how certain individuals, when they, political campaigns, when they are, using these platforms to promote their ideas, regardless of the fact that, whether the information that they're sharing is actually true or not. I know recently Twitter and YouTube have been kind of placing remarks on this tweet may have incorrect information and stuff, but this has only come about so much later than it should have actually happened from the first place. So the fact of the matter is that, social media do need to take, they do take a part. And not just social media, media as a whole plays a part in the crux and the core of the problem. Because the thing you have to always look at with regards to this is that what drives a person towards social media to look out for these things? Social media is the means, but what was the main drive? They managed to get the means to access, people like, organizations like, individuals within IS, whatever, through social media. But what drove them to initially actually engage in that? And it comes down to, what causes radicalism? What causes a person to go towards an extreme, into extremism? And the fact of the matter is, extremism has no religion. Extremism is a philosophy of its own, whereby, you're driven to outside of the middle, the middle ground, the middle discourse, because of the fact that, usually it's from whatever's on the other side is pushing you away. And here, the idea is that, we have, as Muslims, are struggling to integrate into society because of the fact that there are so many barriers that prevent us from integrating with society. That, on the other hand, pushes people away.
I think, yeah.
And unfortunately,
yeah, go on.
And so that's the thing. And unfortunately, the way young Muslims tend to express this kind of rejection is through means that are Islamically speaking wrong. And that's why, for example, our organization, they play a key role into engaging with these young people before they start going into social media. The fact that our organizations, whether it be UKIMI or UKIM, or whether it be MABI, whether it be MCB or the mosques that are doing the jobs to engage the youth, their responsibility is to engage the youth so that they can kind of bring them into a strong religious identity, so that they're aware of what's right.
I also think that there needs to exist a serious dialogue around certain aspects of the religion that might not seem rosy or dandy. I think in our path of assimilation, we've attempted to kind of downplay a lot of things in our religion, or we've attempted to ignore the teaching of these things to our children. And whether or not we're scared to do it, or because it's something that's not relevant for us because we don't need to use it, or we don't need to understand it because it's nothing applicable to our lifestyle, is the wrong way of looking at this. Because at the end of the day, children grow into adults, and then when adults arise, when the flower blossoms, they start looking at things themselves. So whether you can't catch somebody in the impressionable age, more often than not, that will inform their choices when they grow older. And when a child grows into an adult and they've been told not to look into certain areas, or they've not even been told about certain areas, and all of a sudden they come across it, the snowball starts building, etc. And there's nobody to teach them about it in the correct way, because the deen is not straightforward in terms of black being black and white. There are things within the religion that you need guidance with from a teacher. And a lot of social media where a lot of the debates on social media totally take that part out of it and allow people to kind of delve into issues themselves without any supervision or any guidance from people who are more knowledgeable. And when that happens in environments where one dialogue or one kind of narrative is being pushed constantly and there's no one to counteract it, for example, on all of these, for example, Telegram. Telegram's been used constantly by ISIS to kind of push their broadcast messages. They have groups set up. And since Telegram, before WhatsApp became encrypted, was the only encrypted service, messaging service, to this day is still used because of the trust level between Telegram and the users. So, for example, in Telegram, if somebody sends propaganda or videos, etc., a lot of the people within these groups will be in the group to receive this, or will be in the group to receive something which they think is the hack. And then when the thing is sent, wherever the thing is, there's no one there to disagree. All you have is people writing, mashallah, subhanallah, look at this. This is what I believe in. This is 100% true. Israel is taking Palestine. Annexation. Yes, it's like another apartheid. And then they move on to Syria. And then they move on to Sri Lanka. And then they move on to Burma. Because you have to understand that Daesh is not a, purely Syrian-Iraqi organization. They've carried out attacks in Sri Lanka. They've carried out attacks in Burma, in India, in Pakistan, etc. So their reach is huge. And that coupled with the the fact that nobody's there to stop these kids, nobody's there to explain to these kids the true concept or the true meaning of the concepts, they're kind of led astray more easily. There's no one there to hold their hands and pull them back. They're walking. All of a sudden, the tide has just taken them. And whether they swim against the tide at this stage or not is not that doesn't really matter, because the tide's in full swing now. And if you ever know, have you ever seen anyone swim against the tide? If you ever seen anyone swim against the tide usually always wins. And that's the issue with social. In my opinion, that's the issue with social media and Islam, because we've not really been taught Islam holistically. We've been taught Islam that suits us. Oh, you don't need to know this because you live in the West. Or you don't need to know this because it doesn't affect your life. When in reality, everything in the religion affects our lives. And that is now evident with people like Shamima Begum, who went over there because she had certain ideas of Islam. And these ideas weren't being addressed by these youth organizations that we speak of. Even ourselves, we say that we're here to help the youth, etc., but we can't catch everyone. You know what I mean? There are people who slip through the cracks. And then we can't do anything about it because the tide just takes them. So what about these people? Organizations are not there to help them because they can't help them, because they can't find them, they can't see them because they're already being drifted away by the tide. Most of the work that needs to be done on a ground root level with the social media organizations themselves. But since these organizations are not willing to engage in this conversation, then we move it on to parents. And since parents a lot of the time are not willing to engage in these conversations, maybe because a lot of parents of religious children or zealot children, overzealous children, are not really religious themselves a lot of the times. They see their own children as strangers. Where's this child come from? You're 15 years old, all of a sudden you're speaking about this and that. You know what I mean? And they're wondering, where did my child learn this? Because you didn't teach your child, the child went online. And now the online has become the parent. The internet has become the parent. And that's the case with a lot of children. When's the last time I was watching a video on YouTube. It's a reaction channel. And it's called Tribal People React To. So they get tribal people from Pakistan. And they get them to eat like Pringles and drink certain drinks and eat ice cream and because they've never done it before. And then they react to it. And one of them was Tribal People React To Google. And they asked the tribal person, it's like Balochistan somewhere in Pakistan, and they asked him, so if you needed to know something, how would you find out? And they'd go, I'll go to my mother, because my mother's more knowledgeable than my father, but then I'd go to my father if my mother didn't know. And then if I didn't know, I'd go to an elder. If they didn't know, I'd go to an elder in the village, and if they didn't know, I'd leave it. Children, now, if they have a question, generally will not go to their parents. Generally, if the question is not concerning their parents, they will not go to their parents because they know 100% they can find the answer online.
The thing is, so kind of bringing it back now to Shamim Begum, and not just the issue that we're talking about in terms of how can we prevent as a community, you know, more people from not going down that path. And as much as we can try and say that, look, we need to improve in terms of from a holistic point of view, from our parents to being more responsible and making sure that first and foremost they're actually there for the children and looking after the needs of the children, because as well as being able to provide proper guidance to our organizations to be able to provide this kind of level of discussion. It all comes from it also includes you know, our society being a lot more accepting, so that these individuals feel like they are part of the society, that they believe that they can engage and within the society, so that they can feel like, yes, I am a Muslim who has a commitment to, you know, to Britain, and to make society and to make create positive change within British society, and on the wider level as well, not just British society, but even on a wider, positive impact on a global level. But yeah,
I think so. To end on this, to round this whole Shamima Begum thing off, is we have to remember the fact that she was a child, innit? Like Yasmin says, she was groomed at the age of 15, taken to Syria, and usually they don't give you like 10 days rest off. Most of the time, that 10 days was spent doing something with her, trying to find her husband, for example, or trying to find her place within the organization. And when it happened, and then her life just started from then on. She had three kids. All three kids ended up dying. This is by the time she was 18 years old. She had had three kids who had been killed, essentially. People argue that the third child was killed by the British government, because if she was taken to the UK at the time she pleaded with the government, her child most likely would have survived. Her child would have needed to be born in a refugee camp. And then we have people calling her a traitor, saying, after all this has happened to Shamima Begum, after being essentially taken to Syria, because I don't believe that Shamima, a 15-year-old girl from East London, is going to want a life in Syria. If she fully understood what a life in Syria was, if she fully understood that, then she would not want a life there. But she was sold a dream, and obviously when she got there, it was not what she had hoped for. She ended up getting married 10 days later. She didn't have any three kids. All of them end up dying. She lost her husband in terms of, like, they became separated. Now she lives in a refugee camp, all by the age of 18. And then we have people in the UK saying she's a traitor. She's a traitor. She's a traitor. But we can't, we are failing to realize that this is a much, much deeper problem. Because she may be a traitor to you, but the only reason you're saying is that she's a traitor is to absolve yourself of the responsibility and the so-called the sin, the wrongdoing. And I think until we kind of discuss these taboo topics publicly, then nothing's going to happen. Mm. And I think that maybe we might do an episode in the future on if she does come back and the court, the trial. Because when the trial does happen, it must be public. Because the public are going to want to know what's going to happen with her. A dangerous hijabi bride on our streets. We don't want that. We want to know what's going on. We want to follow it like the Amber Heard and Johnny Depp trial. But yeah, that's the take. Hope you guys enjoyed listening to this little conversation. Well, it wasn't really little. How was it? Like an hour or so? Good timing.
Probably a little more.
Alhamdulillah. If you want to follow us on Facebook, you can follow us at The Middle List Podcast, and Instagram, Middle List PC, and on Twitter as well. All of these handles will be in the description of whatever website you use to follow or watch the episode, inshallah. And until next time, my name is Asad. Al-Jasami. And that's me. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum.